You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode number 110 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we are coming to you from Boulevard Park, Washington, the home of the Peltoncast.
Feels good to be back in Boulevard Park.
We've had like a classic summer day because you have the week off and my schedule is flexible.
We're doing what you do in Boulevard Park, and that is driving around, listening to Cube 93, and getting Slurpees.
And wondering why the same songs are constantly playing.
Not wondering, loving that the same songs are constantly playing.
Should we get to what we're drinking? That's the difference from the classic Boulevard Park day. Is when we were children, we were not drinking craft brews.
But before we do that, really quick, I just want to mention about Cube 93 is we had I've been listening a lot to the new Cube 93 because Cube 93, like me being back in Boulevard Park, is back, baby. And
meet the new Cube 93, same as the old Cube 93.
We had such a classic Cube 93 experience was when you're listening to a song when you get out of the car and then you get back in the car like an hour later and the exact song, same song, is playing again.
That's how you know you got it on the right station. Leave it locked in right there.
Anyway, so what are we drinking here today?
So we are drinking the Ballast Point Aloha Sculpin.
Whoa!
Hazy. IPA.
I'm trying to recreate my experience of when I first heard about it because I was excited.
Well, yeah, you saw it in my fridge earlier when you came over here and realized that we were going to be drinking it on the podcast. I need to look up because it doesn't say anything on the actual label about this beer.
It says it's a hazy IPA.
I mean, yeah, but
juicy tropical notes from Brutois yeast.
Okay.
Is that not enough for you?
I want more. I demand more story about my beer. Unfortunately, ballastpoint.com will deliver that to me as soon as I type in my birthday to prove that I am of age. Okay, I have done so. Our award-winning IPA with a paradise vibe.
Yes.
With Aloha Sculpin, we used Brutois yeast to turn our award-winning IPA into a tropical oasis with bright and refreshing notes of mango, pineapple, and
guava.
No orange, though.
There it is. Not official. I was going to say, I can tell you, without even hearing this, what this beer is, and it's an IPA with a bunch of fruit in it.
It's all fruit.
That's all we drink.
It's all beer. You know, it was a real disappointment. I spent the weekend in the Bay Area. We'll get more to that on that later. Did not come across any Pliny the Elder.
Really?
Yeah, that was.
You've been to Texas and you didn't have Lone Star. You've been to the Bay Area and you didn't have Pliny. What are you even doing with your life?
I mean, it's not like I turned it down. Is when I was in Texas, I just couldn't find it. I looked high and low.
Top five worst decisions of your life.
That's fair.
So we've got some things to get to here.
Okay.
Number one, we have to pour one out.
All right.
Do you know what we're pouring one out to?
I don't think I do.
I mean, probably first to Husky Softball, who we were very excited to talk about on Monday morning and are very sad to talk about on Wednesday afternoon.
Accurate.
So we officially do a Peltoncast pouring one out for Husky Softball, but also for someone who passed on this week.
I don't know what this is.
And that is our good friend at Guga31BB.
Oh, yes.
Is now gone from Twitter. It's now at Ben Baldwin.
And Ben B. Baldwin.
Oh, Ben B. Baldwin.
Don't forget the B.
Wow. Two B's in there.
I mean, three B's total.
So the Guga is gone, what you knew and love him as, and he's now something completely different.
I mean, I don't know if we can trust that it's even him because he's no longer got the blue check mark. Of course, then can you trust that I'm me?
I don't really trust that you're you. I mean, I think we have to assume going forward that all accounts are burner accounts.
That's fair. So we also got an email this past week from loyal listener and friend of the pod, Damon, who passed along a question from his friend and loyal listener, Nick.
And shout out to Nick here also.
Appreciate you listening. Was curious, what do we mean when we refer to something as a sneak? And I don't think that the fact in being behind and listening or anything like that explains why you don't understand sneak, because we have just sort of used it without any explanation or context whatsoever.
You know, there's been no official description of what a sneak is. I mean, you know, I think most people have put it together, but
it's basically any time you take a food and eat it at a beer bar that does not serve food.
Well, that's the classic Peltoncast sneak. But I feel like a sneak is any time that you're thinking outside of the box. I mean, especially food related, and getting something that is difficult to get a little bit easier.
Right. I think of it as like kind of pulling one over on people. Like the other people are all doing, they're all going along with the flow, and they're waiting in line for 2 hours for brunch. And you're figuring out a way to not wait in line for 2 hours.
Yes. When third Pelton brother, Tyler Gardner on Twitter, has been doing a Peltoncast sneak of the week and has lately mentioned going to, why can't I think of the ice cream from Portland? Salt and Straw. Going to Salt and Straw and getting their ice cream to go. And I think, do you want to look up these official ones here?
Okay.
When I'm back in Boulevard Park, I don't have a computer in front of me, so it's much harder.
All right. So far, his sneaks of the week, I guess. You mentioned Salt and Straw.
What was the specific Salt and Straw verbiage, though?
Going straight to the freezer at Salt and Straw, cutting the line to check out, and eating a pint at home in your sweats. All right, the second sneak of the week was taking Taco Time from across the street, across Elliott Avenue, to Holy Mountain Brewing, which does not have food. That's a classic sneak right there.
Such a good sneak.
And then the most recent sneak of the week from Tyler, at Teej Gardner, T-E-E-J Gardner, on Twitter, putting Momofuku Som sauce in Trader Joe's bow. And there's only like a brief capture of this, not a full video, so that we can really see exactly what he's doing or how well it works. But I'm intrigued.
Except you don't eat at Trader Joe's.
Or have the Som sauce on me.
It's the whole reason that we don't have a Trader Bros podcast already built out.
Only a matter of time.
It's oftentimes it involves getting food to go and eating it at home.
That's a primary thing.
It doesn't have to just be that. To me, one of your classic sneaks that you invented, just because I feel like you're thinking outside the box here, was at SeaTac Airport, getting Beecher's mac and cheese when you get off the plane. Because I'm so focused on getting out of the airport that I'm not thinking about the food options when I'm leaving the airport.
So I know that usually our mom is picking me up from the airport, and that's going to be a long process. She's going to take a while to get there. So I have some time to go to the Beecher's. But the one thing I wonder about is, will that remain the sneak once the little Woody's, Papa Woody's, in collaboration with Sub Pop, is open right next door?
It's in collaboration with Sub Pop?
It is.
What does that even mean?
I don't know exactly what that entails. We'll have to see when it opens. But I think should be before too long.
Well, the sneak then is going to be get the Beecher's mac and cheese and put it on Lil Woody's burger and make a mac and cheese burger on your own.
Assuming they don't offer that just as part of the menu.
I feel like that has to be a menu item.
It seems so convenient.
This is an official petition to Sub Pop and Lil Woody's and Beecher's to make that an item. Whatever Sub Pop is doing in this situation, they need to make that happen.
Just take that directly to Sub Pop. They're probably very invested in the menu there.
This is what Father John Misty would want on the menu.
Oh, undoubtedly so.
I told you that on Instagram, when you posted the site of the Lil Woody's at the airport, that the possibilities for making mac and cheeseburgers are endless. But actually, there's only one.
Exactly. It's
putting the mac and cheese on the cheeseburger.
I mean, it is endless in terms of the combinations of different types of burger you can have with it.
That's pretty much the primary sneak there, though.
All right, one more bit of listener feedback while we're here. I don't know. Reader feedback would be problematic.
Nobody reads your work, just your podcast work.
Loyal listener Zach sent us a DM on Instagram after we followed each other.
This is Zach Whitman?
No.
Okay.
No, unrelated Zach. Thanks for the follow back. I lived in Seattle, specifically South Seattle, for a couple years.
There it is.
And I'm a huge Hoophead music snob and burrito and burger aficionado, which sounds like you are right in the middle. The Venn diagram yes. of Peltoncast yes. interests. You are sitting right at the middle of that, right there with us. Moved back to Palm Springs, California in 2016, and your pod really makes me feel so much of what I love about Seattle and makes me feel a taste of being there, even when I'm not. So thanks for listening.
Oh, wow. Thanks.
Appreciate that note.
Shouts to Zach.
Yeah. All right, any more business?
If there are any follow-ups, and honestly, we want to hear other sneaks. Here's the thing.
Oh, absolutely. We're always looking to, we're in a relentless pursuit of a competitive edge. Naturally.
For all things, right?
Yeah. It's a win forever philosophy in all aspects of our life, except maybe who to speak to the team.
Wait, what? Oh, yeah.
All right, moving on.
But if you have sneaks, please send them to us. What is the email again?
peltoncast@gmail.com.
You can DM us on Instagram. You can tweet at Peltoncast. You can send an email to peltoncast@gmail.com. We are available to hear about sneaks.
Very available. Okay, let's get into this week's burrito/taco review, where we went a little bit outside the box, speaking of that thought for our sneaks. So there is only one location that will feature both in this burrito taco search, and then also in our search for Seattle's best barbecue in 2025. That location is, of course, Pecos Pit Barbecue, a place that I have been going since either 2004 or 2005.
Wow. It's won your award for best barbecue in Seattle.
Every single year since then.
The Pelton list.
Yeah. Which we have to do publicly at some point. We got to figure out who the
You don't even do it privately. You just have given the word to Pecos.
Okay. Well, we have to do it officially at some point. We have to figure out who the right third Pelton brother is for that podcast and do it. Anyways.
If only Nate Duncan lived in Seattle.
So my Sonics coworkers had been going there for many years before they brought me into the fold and introduced me to it after I started working there full time. And when I started going,
it's a bit of a drive.
It is. Oh yeah, it's located across the street from the Starbucks headquarters in SoDo.
And you were in where? You were near Key Arena. Yeah. Wow, that's a hike for lunch.
It well worth it.
No wonder the team moved.
I think it had more to do with the other side of the street than the side we were on.
Yes.
Notice that we're not pouring one out for that particular individual. Anyway.
An official Pelton Cast good riddance.
When I first started going there, the menu was relatively simple. Their specialty, it's West Texas barbecue. The Pecos River, I believe, is in West Texas. And I think
somebody's going to correct us, and it's going to be in the heart of the Midwest.
Anyways, their specialty is shredded beef brisket. You can also get shredded pork or sliced beef brisket or pork on a sandwich bun with this amazing barbecue sauce. My favorite barbecue sauce I have ever tasted. I don't know if you agree with that.
Maybe 2026 we do the best barbecue sauce in Seattle, but
well, I think that'll be part of best barbecue.
I think their food is amazing, and I feel like the barbecue sauce has to be part of it.
Yeah, to me, it's the most important part of it, even more so than the barbecued meat itself. That's okay. How I feel about it. And I know that this would disappoint the Central Texas barbecue lobby. I'm a sauce guy when it comes to barbecue. Anyways, so they had that. The sides of beans and coleslaw, and that was pretty much the entire menu and what they were actually making there when I first started.
And you were happy with it.
Oh, it was more than enough.
The only thing you said to yourself was, this place needs Shinerbach at it, because you can't get Lone Star in Washington State.
And needs to be open not just for lunch.
Which they now
weekday.
Have beers at Pecos, right?
Not at the main Pecos.
Oh, okay. So this is only in the West Seattle one that they have it.
So Pecos, a few years ago, it began an expansion process, and in 2016, they opened a location in West Seattle. I believe it's the person who, I don't know if they founded or franchised Red Robin, but they're behind this expansion.
Oh, wow. There's about to be like 10,000 Pecos.
They're with an eye towards making local barbecue chain Pecos a national spot. Two more locations are apparently forthcoming, according to the website, which I had not known until I was doing my research for this. One in Federal Way, and then one at 143rd in Aurora in North Seattle. So,
man, more going every direction.
But I gotta say, as much as I like the hours, and as much as I like the beer at the West Seattle location, the original South Seattle SoDo location still impossible.
That's the actual pit, right?
Yeah.
If there's a Pecos Pit Barbecue, that's the pit right there.
There better be a pit. So that's where we went. But anyway, what they have done, in addition to the expanding the locations, they have also expanded the menu.
Hello.
Now, all the time you can get mac and cheese there, either with the barbecue in it or as a side. Then on Thursdays and Fridays, they offer barbecue nachos. And on Mondays and Tuesdays, they offer a barbecue burrito known as the Burrito Willy, where you get the same, in this case, shredded pork with rice and beans and cheese in a burrito.
What do they offer on Wednesdays?
Nothing special on Wednesdays, I don't think.
Okay.
Poor Wednesday.
Okay, so we had this, they call it the Burrito Willy.
Yes.
We had this burrito yesterday. You mentioned that they land on Mondays and Tuesdays, so we needed to get it immediately.
This was an important week for you to go, because normally, again, it's difficult for you to get there during lunch, and there's no ability to go for you any other time.
I don't keep Sonic's hours.
No, apparently you don't. So, yes, we went yesterday. I'd had it twice before. This was your first time.
Yes.
Give me your first impressions of the Pecos Pit barbecue burrito.
Okay, so just a little description of the burrito. You've got the Pecos meat, which is excellent, right?
Yes.
Beans, rice, and then cheese. I would say it was pretty cheesy around the outside, almost like a quesarito. Did you notice that?
I think that's accurate. I mean, I don't know if that's intentional, but that's how it works out.
And then at the very bottom, there's like a little smidgen of salsa. Did you get that?
I'm very little, if any.
You're like, why is this even here at the bottom?
Because you know what they should be doing? What I would want them to do, just use barbecue sauce as the salsa in the burrito.
There should have been a shitload of barbecue sauce in there, right? Because I ate it on its own. I had a few bites on its own without the barbecue sauce. You were wise enough. This is a sneak also. I mean, to be honest.
I was going to say.
You were wise enough to get cups of barbecue sauce, and they are not small cups. Those are Texas-sized cups of barbecue sauce.
That is accurate. The first time I went there, I asked them, can I get barbecue sauce as the sauce? And they're like, no, we don't do that. So I said, okay, well, then can I get barbecue sauce on the side and effectively use it like salsa that you would get at a taqueria where you're either dipping in there or pouring it on the top before you eat each bite and getting that flavor, which you're going to want.
Well, and before I'd had that, when I had the bites, just kind of, I had a few bites normal without the barbecue sauce, and those were fine. They weren't amazing. They were pretty good. The meat is still great, right?
Yes.
But then when I added the barbecue sauce, it's like an explosion of flavors in my mouth. I mean, it took it up at least 10 points in the burrito rating
10
scale.
10 points? Huh. I mean, what I would say is, I mean, obviously the barbecue sauce is crucial, but this is a solid burrito in terms of its composition. Like, I think it's competitive with most non-Tacos Chuquis burritos in Seattle.
I more or less agree with that. Especially, I mean, if it had the barbecue sauce in it perfectly all the time, I feel like we'd be talking about maybe not a real competitor for best burrito in Seattle, but we'd be talking about one of the very good burritos in Seattle.
I mean, certainly something capable of making the bracket, I would say, which I think with the barbecue sauce, this is.
So we need to officially petition Pecos Pit Barbecue. I mean, they seem like they're active on the internet, right? They like the post on Instagram right away. They've got Mr. Red Robin leading the expansion. Put the barbecue sauce in the burrito. What are you doing, Pecos Pit? What are you waiting for? There's no rule against it. Put the barbecue sauce in the burrito. And maybe a little bit of sour cream.
Yes, 100%. Which they have to have for the nachos, I'm presuming. I've had the nachos, but I can't specifically remember.
You had those two things, and you have got an excellent burrito. Right now, you have a very good burrito. You had those two things, and I think you have that burrito on your menu 5 days a week.
So I would say that the Pecos Pit burrito suffers from the same problem as Marination Tacos, which is very good, it's very competitive, but not the best thing on the menu.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the sandwich is still the best thing. Yeah. I mean, every once in a while, I'll order the burrito just to mix it up. But otherwise, generally, the vast majority of the time, I'm going with the sandwich.
So you're saying Pecos Pit is one of those locations where they don't need a diverse menu because they do one thing really well.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not unhappy about the diverse menu. There's no downside to it for me, but it's kind of overshadowed.
I mean, that sliced beef sandwich is so good.
I mean, Pecos is the Tacos Chuquis of our search for Seattle's best barbecue. No two ways about it.
I don't know if I feel that way. I don't have another competitor, but I don't know if I feel as strongly about Pecos as you do.
That's probably fair. I feel very strongly about Pecos.
You really do. You feel maybe a little bit too strongly.
All right, what is your rating?
I'm going to give it a 90.
I also was going to go with a 90.
All right.
Consensus, 90.
So you mentioned that you were in the Bay Area. Were you able to hit up any burrito places while you were down there?
Oh, yes, I was. I was able to hit up the two premier locations in the Mission District, home of the Mission-style burrito that has since taken the country by storm. With, I don't know, probably Chipotle in particular, but in general, that's now our template for what a burrito is.
You really think so? It's a Mission style burrito?
I think so, yeah.
Huh. Because Mission style burritos have, or is that only a California burrito that is French fries?
The French fries is a San Diego thing. That's not a Mission style thing.
Okay, no. So describe exactly a Mission style burrito to me.
I mean, again, it's now become a burrito because it's just, I mean, the inclusion of guac and sour cream, I don't know if that was standard before that. And it's still like an optional choice at these locations.
It's big time guac territory, though.
Yeah, understandably so. And just, you know, the Mission burrito locations, they have come close to perfecting making sure that you're getting everything in the right quantities, everything well mixed. There's no bad bites.
All right.
So anyway, so I went to the two locations, La Taqueria, which is my personal favorite. I went to on Thursday, the day I got in before game one of the NBA Finals. And then just before I was leaving the Bay Area on Monday, I went to El Farolito, which is, I think, considered like the highest rated online of these locations. I was visiting. So both of these places were in the 538 burrito bracket. El Farolito was surprisingly upset in the first round by a third location in the Mission District, Cancun, which I went to during the 2015 finals or 2016 finals, the first time I had been to any of these places. I went to all three of them. I thought Cancun was a pretty distant third at that point.
Really?
And that La Taqueria was a clear number one.
Huh.
So now I've been to La Taqueria 3 years in a row. This was my second time at El Farolito, and that opinion was reinforced. Okay. La Taqueria is the best burrito in the world, or at least that I've had. I mean, maybe there's a better one local out there.
And you've had every burrito in the world. But if your world extends from Seattle all the way to Oakland.
San Francisco, it's farther south.
Okay, fine.
And I've had a lot of burritos in LA, I'll have you know, good sir.
Okay, fine. So if the world is the states of Washington and California, best burrito in the world.
I mean, look, it won. La Taqueria, I mentioned El Farolito got upset. La Taqueria won the 538 burrito bracket. This is not like a controversial opinion that it's the best burrito.
So you think after you've been eating these burritos in Seattle critically for the last couple of months here, you think La Taqueria is clearly the best, seriously better than Tacos Chuki's?
Yes. I mean, they're doing different things. The baby burrito at Tacos Chuki's, like, it's concentrated meat. It's kind of small. You can eat two of them and two tacos. That's great. I love that. I love everything about it. But in terms of the pure burrito itself, yeah, La Taqueria is another level. So in the past, I think I had gone with what the 538 recommended order was, which was carnitas, which weirdly, I have not been getting it ordering it grilled. You order it Dorado, which is not on the menu, but you can do that to get it, to get your tortilla grilled.
What does that mean? Dorado means they grill the tortilla?
Yes.
What does Dorado mean in Spanish?
I mean, I think it just means grilled.
Okay.
I don't think it's technically grilled.
El Dorado means the grilled?
No, it's something slightly different.
That can't be right.
You're right. Good point. Golden. That's right.
Okay.
Golden. So when you're getting a grilled, it becomes golden. I have not done that for whatever reason. But this time I switched it up and got the carne asada. And let me tell you, I thought that was a great choice.
Yeah, you haven't done the Dorado, though?
No.
What? What are you doing?
I don't know. I don't know. I have no justification for that. I didn't read the 538 review this time until after I was back in Seattle. The carne asada was, it was, the burrito was, to steal one of your favorite phrases, bursting with flavor. It was an incredible amount of flavor. And it was so, there was the juices from the meat made everything around them taste better. It was just an amazing experience. And then, like I said, the perfect proportioning of the other ingredients in that burrito. I mean, I reached burrito nirvana while I was eating that.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do they have al pastor?
They do not. El Farolito does have al pastor, which is what I went to when I went there on Monday. And that's a slightly larger burrito, I would say. You're getting more for your buck. But even the super burrito option they sell, it doesn't come with much avocado. And so it's a drier experience than the La Taqueria burrito, which I think is a big reason for the difference. But it's a must, I think, to go with some salsa. I went with some crema green salsa to go alongside with it to give it some of that wetness that you're going to need.
That crema salsa is amazing.
Keep it from drying out. So, I mean, that was really good. Like, when I first, I reversed the order that I went to them in 2016. I went first to El Farolito with Nate Duncan because it's his favorite of the two locations. And so when I had it, I was like, well, this is the best burrito I've ever had. And then the next day I went to La Taqueria and like, nope, this is the best burrito I've ever had.
Who did you go with this time?
No, and I just went over by myself.
Okay, so you'd already name dropped Nate Duncan.
I mean, there were several meals with Nate Duncan, including I posted on Instagram. We went to Angeline's Kitchen in Berkeley, I should say, for New Orleans Cajun Creole style brunch, and that was outstanding. I also, of course, made time to visit one of my favorite restaurants anywhere, Burma Superstar, multiple locations in the Bay Area. I went to one of the spot in Oakland this time around for Burmese food, which is outstanding. Always make sure to get there when I'm down in the Bay Area. So that was, I guess, the highlights, I would say, of the weekend of eating.
Okay. Any other thoughts on Bay Area food?
I think that pretty much covers it. Subject of tacos, Chuki's. Did we want to talk about loyal listener Randy visiting there for the first time?
We have Monday? To.
Yeah, checked in with us, as you should do. Checked in with us on Twitter to make sure he was getting the right Pelton Cast.
Well, you can also just know what the Pelton Cast order is. You don't have to check in first. It's not that complicated.
But you want to be sure. Make sure you're getting the Pelton Cast. Now, he says he originally ordered two tacos, Chuki's, and then the baby burrito. No beer, since he had to go back to work. But then after finishing all of that, not quite the full Pelton Cast, then went back in for more and maybe completed the
It full looked like Pelton he had another baby burrito and two molitas.
That's true. I guess that was two house tacos and two molitas. So still not a full Pelton Cast, but...
He never got a second burrito?
I don't think so, but still a wide variety of the menu.
We have to have the molitas first, because I've actually never had them at Tacos Chuggies.
I mean, I have.
And you didn't like them that much?
I mean, they were fine, but not worth giving up the rest of the Pelton Cast.
Okay, but I mean, you could do a hearty Pelton Cast of two tacos, two burritos, two molitas, and two tecates.
Oh, man. That is an incredible order there.
If you're really hungry, if you have a real hunger, that would be a hearty Pelton Cast that I've just invented.
But the important thing is that Randy replied, speechless, it was everything I could have dreamed of and or hoped for. And Tacos Chuki's continues, and I don't think we can say this about anything else we've recommended on this podcast, 100% satisfaction rate for Tacos Chuki's.
I think that's true. It's kind of amazing. I mean, we talk about the one that I would consider to be closest would be Loretta's and the Tavern Burger. Where I don't know if I personally have heard anybody saying anything bad about the Loretta's Tavern Burger, but it feels like with Tacos Chuki's, the approval rating is definitely 100%.
There's some people that go to Loretta's and they don't rave about it. And everyone that goes to Tacos Chuki's raves about it.
Yes.
Which is the difference.
It's kind of amazing having a restaurant which has like 100% approval rating from anybody that we talk to. And like I mentioned to you before, people tell us whenever they go to Tacos Chuki's. We see this a lot.
Please keep doing that.
Yeah, no, don't let it stop. We want to know.
I mean, hopefully at some point we'll run out of people to go to Tacos Chuki's for the first time. But just tell us every time you keep going.
I don't want to hopefully run out. There's always more.
Okay.
We can reach every person.
You know what is a place I went to for the first time today? You know that because you were there.
Well, before then, I have some other taco related business.
Okay. Yes.
So for this next week, I feel like I went to two cantinas this week in Georgetown.
Yes.
Which you didn't make it to, so we're not going to officially review it. But I feel like you should try to go there in the next week, and we'll talk about that on next week's podcast.
Absolutely, and we should maybe try to hit up a second location because I'm starting to feel the pressure of the conclusion of this bracket upon us.
Oh, I never want it to come.
I mean, you know what? Maybe we don't want to talk about the Seahawks this year. Maybe we just extend the burrito bracket through the fall.
Instead of talking about the Seahawks, we're just talking burritos.
Just concluded Husky basketball season. And that'll be
That's what we want to talk about. Yeah. Just straight through Husky basketball season two.
Husky basketball could be good next year. I don't know.
Maybe we pick it up next UW softball season.
I think John Wilner picked them third in the Pac-12 next season. I think that's optimistic, but not unreasonable.
Okay, so maybe two cantinas and another location for this week.
Yeah, we'll continue pondering that, and of course post it on Instagram wherever we go.
But also on Instagram this last week, I feel like it has to be mentioned. I just want to talk about this for 1 second.
Oh yeah, you should.
The fine folks at Taco Time, our good friends, posted. Can you pull up this Instagram for the exact verbiage? I said verbiage twice.
I would be happy to do so. It feels like a subtle nod to the Pelton Cast, and more specifically, perhaps, to Talkin' Taco Time, because they posted about, and now I can't find it. Here we are. Perfect road trip listening, and it's a seemingly apocryphal Taco Time, the podcast.
I feel like we'd be able to find this podcast if it has actually had 111 episodes.
That's true. Episode 111, the most recent episode on here, Chris Burritos. A deep dive into the mythological origins of the crisp burrito and the scholars who are passionately focused. And that's where it trails off. I mean, come on.
We're those scholars.
We are certainly passionate.
I'm like accruing Taco Time stories, saving them for Talking Taco Time. Our mom mentioned that somebody who she went to high school with may have helped invent Crustos. And I was like, get her on the pod. I was like, find me this person's contact info that our mom hasn't talked to since high school, which she graduated in 1969.
The other fake episode, episode number 110, which coincidentally, the number of this episode of the Pelton Cast.
Oh, wow.
Mexi Fries. I like that it has the explicit rating on here. What has been the cultural impact of Mexi Fries? Look no further than this local community of forest dwellers who paint large Renaissance-style portraits of their favorite snack. I mean, I want to listen to this podcast, which is why we got to make this podcast.
Man, I just want to listen to that podcast too, though.
I mean, we can do it.
Taco Time the
podcast. I don't know if we're going to find these.
It's called Taco Time the podcast?
Yes. So.
So we're ready. Dubs and four.
Okay, as I was saying earlier, a place that I had never been to, shamefully had never been to, until today.
Especially because you're borderline unemployed. Like, it's kind of crazy that you hadn't been there.
Again, flexible schedule. Il Corvo Pasta.
Also, with these epic lunches you were taking with the Sonics, too. Well,
the Sonics, I don't think Il Corvo was open by the time the Sonics moved. I hate to break it to you.
I'm curious to find out. I've been there one time, and it was over 4 years ago. So it'd been a while for me also.
Really? That'd been that long. So it's the famous cousin Katie who is most frequently hitting up Il Corvo.
So naturally, having this week off, we went there with the famous cousin Katie. And you'd never had Il Corvo Pasta before. What did you think?
Pretty good. I mean, I think one of the things that makes Il Corvo interesting is the fact that, you know, it seems like the pappardelle is on the menu daily, mm-hmm. but the other two handmade pasta selections are changing on a daily basis. And I don't know if we got the ones that are most suited to my interest today.
Maybe they weren't the most suited to your interest, I suppose, but this is such high quality pasta that we're dealing in here. And pasta is one of the better foods.
It's a pretty good food.
I've almost never met a pasta I didn't like.
Met a pasta?
Right? I mean, part of the reason that I like ramen so much is because ramen's kind of like pasta. I've been eating a lot of Top Ramen lately, and I just boil it all the way down so that it's just like ramen, no water.
Yeah, you can definitely do that.
Oh, it's amazing, and it's basically making a pasta. Just pasta in every form is excellent, and this is near the highest form of pasta that you're going to get.
Yeah, that's probably true.
And they deal with all sorts of different types of pastas, kind of thinking outside of the box sometimes, mixtures, and you know that it's handcrafted every single day, something new and interesting just for you with a price point of $9.75 for a bowl. This is unbelievable.
Yeah, no.
The wine is cheap, and all of the accoutrement is cheap, right?
Yeah.
Like $3.75 for focaccia. Olives are cheap. Shortbread is cheap. Everything that you could want. Salads between like $3 and $5. Plus a $3 glass of wine, which I mentioned earlier, but it remains
$4
for the glass of wine. I mean, at most restaurants that are serving this high quality of pasta, it'd be like a $10 glass of wine. And the bread would be $12. And the pasta would be $20+. I mean, what you're getting is you are getting such amazing food at amazing prices.
The trade-off is that you're waiting in line.
You just have to wait in line and be available from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m.
Yeah, you can't be. You need your schedule to be as flexible as mine is.
But I just loved everything about this experience. I mean, to me, this is the number one place that not being able to go for lunches like this or working in the area or whatever, this is the biggest shame about it, not being able to go to Il Corvo.
Okay.
Maybe you don't like pasta. I don't know.
I gotta say, I don't think I like pasta as much as you do. Mm. Which is weird because I also probably my single favorite food in the world is our family recipe ravioli. But for some reason, maybe because of the fact that I'm so interested in handmade pasta like that.
This is not handmade pasta!
I get that! I know, I'm saying that. So this should be, you know, in my ballpark.
Ugh. I mean, it's like you're living out. You know, you watch Aziz Ansari's Master of None, right? Not you, of course, because it's not Franklin and Bash. Which toast to Franklin and Bash? Are they actually coming back?
No.
Oh, I didn't understand MPG's Instagram.
He was just reminiscing about FNB.
Well, pour one out for Franklin and Bash for still being gone.
We're toasting. We're, you know,
you people on the internet haven't rallied together enough. to get it brought back by a streaming service. But it's like watching season two of Master of None. You see all this amazing pasta, and you're like, I want to eat that pasta. And you can go eat it right here in Seattle.
But only until 3 p.m.
You have to be available from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. and be willing to wait in a line.
Il Corvo opened in 2013, it appears. Several years after the Sonics moved. Okay, one last thing. We've got a lot of food this week.
Man.
And thank goodness.
I'm just animated about your...
you want to talk about sports.
Your muted response to Il Corvo.
Did you see that we learned some more details about Shake Shack Seattle this week?
I did. I did see this.
Thanks to loyal listener Jimmy for bringing this to our attention on Twitter. Shake Shack has scheduled a pop-up for June 23rd, Saturday, June 23rd, in the Canlis parking lot from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m., featuring, in addition to the classic shake, burger, and fries, a Dungeness crab melt using the crab from Canlis, plus live performances by local bands. It will be impossible for anyone to actually go to this.
I'm trying to think about, like, where this is even happening. I mean, Canlis is in such a strange place.
And it's not a big parking lot or anything. So, yeah, it's going to be tight. It's gonna be a tougher wait than even Il Corvo, which is why we need to come up with a sneak.
I don't know what the sneak could be. I mean, I think waiting till the fall might be the sneak.
That's probably not gonna be much of a sneak in itself. So we learned that the actual Shake Shack location in South Lake Union scheduled to open in September.
Okay. So they had said, I think, summer 2018. And I got the feeling that maybe that's why they decided to do this pop-up. Because it's like Kanye had to get his album out, right? He'd set a date. You had to put something out. They said summer 2018. So they had to do something here.
Okay.
The partnership with Canlis is kind of interesting.
You know, it's interesting. Danny Meyer had sort of alluded to this or presaged this when he first talked about the decision to come to Seattle. He referenced, like, how much, you know, the relationship with Canlis is something that could be reflected in the menu. Huh. So I wasn't surprised by it.
I mean, I guess you want it to be exclusive and like a special party. But if this were done, I mean, they should recognize how big the demand is here. Look, I'm demanding things of businesses today. Move this to a larger park, right? Seattle Center?
I don't know if they want that.
Move this to the mural.
I think they want this.
We're not going to get these burgers.
I think we need to find a way to get with Shake Shack on some social media and get it in here.
Man.
That's what I'm saying. We are influencers.
We're not going to be eating these burgers. We're not going to have a Dungeness crab melt. We're getting none of it because it's going to be so hard to do logistically.
Yes.
If this were at the mural stage at Seattle Center, the bands could play. You could set up booths, hundreds of people serving Shack burgers and Dungeness
crab
melts.
That's not what they want. That's not, I mean.
This is what the people want.
They're not McDonald's. They're Shake Shack.
Fucking McDonald's. I'm saying one day.
They're not going for volume here. That is not their goal.
God, next you're going to argue that they shouldn't put the barbecue sauce right in the burrito.
I would never argue that.
This is interesting news, though. I mean, getting an update is nice.
Yeah. Whew. Anything else on food?
Man, I just got a lot of feelings. I mean, doing a lot of eating this week.
And you're doing a lot of taking is on that food. So nothing really new on the NHL to Seattle front, other than the fact that it looks like the Las Vegas Golden Knights may not win the championship in their first year of existence. What a disappointment. Do we even want an expansion team now?
Yeah, I'm sorry for those fans. It's who I'm really sorry for.
So last week we talked about what Gary Bettman talked about in his State of the League address before game one of the Stanley Cup Finals. Last week, of course, was game one of the NBA Finals, and before that, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver delivered his similar press conference and was inevitably asked about expansion. Specifically, he was asked about expansion to Las Vegas in the wake of the Knights' success, but he talked more generally about expansion, and here, I think, was the most notable part of what he had to say, which, you know, more or less consistent with what he's been saying for the last several years here. Expansion, at least for right now, even to the question earlier about parity, I'm very focused on creating a competitive 30-team league right now. Understandably, people are saying, can't you do more to create more competition among your 30 teams, at least from a competitive standpoint? My first reaction isn't to think, all right, let's add a 31st team or a 32nd team. It is to see what it is we can do system-wise, training-wise, whatever it takes to create more competition within this league. But invariably, as I've said before, it's only natural for any business to grow and expand at some point, so we'll look back to expansion. It's not just Las Vegas. There are lots of terrific markets out there in the United States, and some in countries attached to the United States, who also have wonderful cities that could potentially house NBA teams. So those are all things we'll continue to look at.
And you're saying he's talking about Mexico City here?
He's 100% talking about Mexico City.
Not Vancouver like we've all been wanting?
I was not actually in the room, but was watching this press conference on a monitor.
From Al Farolito.
Yes, in the auxiliary press room. And one of the other NBA writers in there was like, man, I wish I had a photo of your face when he said that line about Mexico City.
I don't consider us to be in competition with Mexico City.
I think that's reasonable. I mean, when they decide to go to Mexico City, it will be almost certainly through expansion. I don't think there would be a team moving there.
Okay.
Whereas the most realistic chance for the Seattle to get an NBA team at this point is going to be through expansion.
Through expansion, not a team moving.
I'm sorry, through a team moving. I misspoke there, yes. Yes, I don't think the league is expanding anytime in the immediate future.
Okay.
And
is there anything that we make of these comments or...
Other than that, not really. Other than, again, the same timetable. Expansion will probably happen at some point, but not anytime soon.
Okay.
So, there we are. In happier news, let's get to your favorite segment.
Don't burn yourself. We got Mariners hot takes coming at you.
Okay, I have just one hot take this week. And that is, this Seattle Mariners baseball team is so good, you are just about to start hating on them.
Oh, wow.
It's a hot take and a prediction. I have no idea what you're going to say. We haven't talked about this. But this team is playing so well that you are ready to start your hate.
I mean, maybe I'm just going to have to look at the run differential column of the standings because that does the hate for me.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it's right there in black and white. The Mariners have outscored their opponents by 23 runs this season. You want to guess how many runs the Astros have outscored their
opponents?
It's
like 169 or something.
That's not that many. You set the bar too high. It's 116. There's a 93-run gap
close.
In terms of...
116.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's a 93-run gap in terms of differential between these two teams, and yet the Mariners are two games ahead in the standings. There is the Angels have a plus 34 run differential, 11 runs better than the Mariners, and yet somehow the Mariners are 5 games ahead of the Angels in the standings.
There's only stat that I look at, and that is wins and losses.
Oh boy. I mean, look, I think the Mariners, they're tracking well to be in position to compete for the second wild card.
I mean, what if you look at FanGraphs, what their percentage chance of making the playoffs are? Because it's skyrocketed.
It's over 50-50 now.
Over 50% chance, which is kind of funny for a team that has a two-game lead over the Astros.
I don't know what the Astros are off the top of my head, but it's much higher than that because of the fact that eventually that run differential is going to win out, especially given that it's only a two-game gap in the standings. Yes, the Astros are currently at 99% to make the playoffs.
99%? I'm going to get an overrated chance starting. And the Mariners currently sit at 55% to make the playoffs.
I didn't know that you normally rounded up 0.3% to the higher percent. That's unexpected.
Any percent that's above 1 goes up to the next percent. No, we're talking about the Mariners' chances of making the playoffs.
When we're talking about the Mariners' chances of making the playoffs, perhaps.
Well, your little run differential didn't seem to matter too much yesterday.
That was an impressive performance. The Mariners evened that gap up a little bit. Think about how large it was before they destroyed the Astros.
Dropping 7 runs in the first inning, which was 5 more than James Paxton needed for the game.
That's accurate. Another dominant start by the Big Maple.
And this team, especially the pitching staff, the crazy thing is we've known that the team had gotten better since Robinson Cano was suspended. The pitching staff, since Robinson Cano has been suspended, looking like the best in baseball. I mean, this is unbelievable what they're doing.
I'm looking forward to your Ewing theory take on Robinson Cano.
I don't even need a Ewing theory take, right? The play is the Ewing theory. It's over. They're clearly better without Robinson Cano than they are with Robinson Cano.
If you say so. The Mariners also had the MLB draft this week in the first round with the 14th overall pick. They took right-handed starting pitcher Logan Gilbert from Stetson University. I don't know if Baby Fantasy Genius could accurately come up with Stetson University's nickname, but the fact is Stetson actually has a pretty good track record in terms of pitching, producing MLB pitchers, both Corey Kluber and Jacob deGrom in recent years. The Mariners had drafted a hitter their last...
This guy's going to win the Cy Young at some point.
Oh, wow. There's a hot take. Hasn't even signed yet. The Mariners had drafted a hitter in the first round the last 5 years, so a little bit of a strange of strategy here to go with a more polished college starting pitcher.
Do you know where? What pick was this, by the way?
14th.
14th pick in the draft. I mean, so he's somebody who could be in the majors within the next. He's a college starting pitcher, right?
Yes.
He kind of needs to be in the majors relatively soon.
I don't know about needs, but you would think that he's a little bit ahead in the development curve. I mean,
within like the next 3 years, though.
3 years is probably a realistic timetable.
So this is something. It's a nod saying this team right now, with the players that they have, younger players. I mean, you look at it and you say the core isn't what we thought it was of Cano and Cruz. The core now is Guillermo Heredia, James Paxton, Mitch Haniger, Gene Segura.
Okay.
I mean, this is the one situation where you take a team who looked not old at the beginning of the season, right? And then quickly throughout the year has shown that kind of the core of the players that matter to them is much younger than we initially thought.
Okay.
You disagree with this?
I mean, sure.
Plus, Felix was out there dueling. I mean, you know that things are clicking when Felix is out there pitching 8 innings of one-run baseball. I mean, how great was that to see?
I mean, I didn't see it, so sure.
Whew. And the Mariners pulling it out in the 8th and getting Felix a win last weekend, that was something.
Sure.
You don't think this is something?
I just have no take on it whatsoever. I was unaware that it happened.
You're going to have to start being aware of it.
So that I can hate on it?
Yes. This is your hating that's happening already.
It was a good take. It was not a bold prediction, but it was an accurate one. Speaking of teams that are looking old.
Oh, no.
Your Seattle Sounders. Another scoreless 2-0 defeat last Saturday at Real Salt Lake. And things are looking bleak, man. I mean, this was not a case where the Sounders dominated play and yet didn't manage to score a goal and somehow lost anyway.
Okay, so here's the one thing that I want to say about the Mariners. Sometimes having wins in your pocket matters.
Obviously. It's better to have those wins to not have those wins. But it's not like they have that many wins in their pocket compared to the Astros. Again, I think they're in good shape for the second wild card, which is why last week's hot takes said that they were coming not for the AL West division, but for that second wild card.
Sometimes having all these losses adds up at some point.
It's starting to add up for the Sounders, whose playoff odds, according to 538 Soccer Power Index, tumbled again now down to 34%, which is still amazing because they're in last place.
By far. How many points have the Sounders, have they scored 5 points for the
season? 8 points. They have achieved 8 points from their matches. There's one other team on 8 points. This week they also facing DC United to come in last in the East on 9 points.
And the Sounders will lose till 2-0.
So the Sounders, after this anemic attack at Real Salt Lake, where they had 0.3 shot-based expected goals, according to the Soccer Power Index model, 0.8 non-shot expected goals, and of course, again, did not score despite the return of striker Will Bruin. Now, that was the kickoff of a stretch of 4 games in 12 days. Tonight, as we record this, Wednesday night, they'll face Sacramento Republic FC in the U.S. Open Cup. Then on Saturday, they host DC United, and then one more match coming up after that before, I think, a brief break for the World
Cup. Finally today, they're playing a team that's at their level.
So we'll see. The lineup probably will be a lot of S2 and young players, giving them an opportunity, especially because of this congested schedule. But one small bit of good news is that the Sounders will at some point be getting Nicola Ladero back because he was left out of Uruguay's World Cup roster. So unclear when he's going to return. Uruguay has a friendly on Thursday before departing for Russia for the World Cup. And the health status of Lodero, which probably factored into this decision, still unknown, as he, of course, was dealing with a broken toe before he went to the reported to his national
team. I almost would have rather had Lodero make the squad and play in the World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, all things considered, you'd rather have it for him. But the Sounders could use any boost of creativity and attacking talent that they can get.
When does the transfer window open? July 1st? Or are MLS teams allowed to make trades whenever and sign players whenever?
I mean, the rules apply a little differently, but yes, I think the transfer window, I think July 1st sounds right.
Okay, I mean, if nothing changes in this next month, if they still look pretty weak at the attack, if they're sitting on a meek amount of points, this is going to be blow it up time right now. Unless they want to wait until the end of the year, I mean, this is going to be try to find something that's working as quickly as possible time. This is going to be try to get younger as quickly as possible because this team is not in a good position right now.
Not particularly, no. I mean, they have younger players who are involved as part of the roster, but they, at least the ones in attack with Jordan Morris injured, have not provided much.
And I just don't see how Schmetz makes it through the year. Again, things would have to change. Like, okay, I can see it because they've done it the last 2 years. Things have turned around very quickly, but they never got this bad.
I mean, Jordan Morris got hurt and Clint Dempsey hasn't played well all season. And like, that's it. That's out. I mean, Ladero's been hurt and is now gone. Like, those are all the guys you're counting on to help you score goals. Otherwise, it's Christian Roldan and Will Bruin. And like, I love Christian Roldan, great and versatile player, but you can't count on him as the engine of your offense. And Will Bruin is your primary goal scorer is a problem.
We probably thought and those even players been hurt. Were better than they actually were.
Because they got to
play with those other players.
Yeah, they got to play off those guys. It's one thing for Will Bruin to be playing off Clint Dempsey. It's another thing for him to be playing instead of Clint Dempsey or to be playing off Jordan Morris. So I really think it's the roster, not the coaching.
That might be true, but I just don't see how he's going to outlast it.
I mean, perhaps. He's still a local legend. But by the way, I don't know if you saw this. The third brother, Felton brother, Mike Bate pointed out that we were searching the wrong hashtag. It should have been Schmetzer out.
Hashtag Schmetzer out.
Which he was contributing to last
week. Yes. Proudly contributing to.
The Seattle Reign, a scoreless draw. They were channeling the Sounders in a scoreless draw against the Orlando Pride at home. They were playing without Megan Rapinoe due to a call-up to the U.S. Women's National Team. And this weekend is, in fact, an international break for the NWSL, so the Reign will be off after that. The Seattle Storm extended their winning streak to 5 by blowing out the Las Vegas Aces last Thursday. Ugh. Leading by as many as 43 points
wow.
in that game and setting a WNBA record with 17 3-pointers.
Really?
Opposite game one of the NBA
Are
finals.
They shooting threes in the WNBA now?
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Not as many as the NBA. But the Storm leads the league in three attempt rate as far as last I checked. The Storm had their winning streak, their 5-game winning streak, snapped on Saturday in Dallas. They played without Sue Bird, who sat out officially for rest. Although she posted on Instagram she was had a doctor's visit, so I don't know if there's anything more going on here than rest. Huh. But I guess we'll find out. The Storm play on Thursday at the LA Sparks. With Sue Bird out, Jordan Canada, the rookie, had 9 points, 9 assists, and 5 steals in her first career start. Storm was competitive throughout this game before losing 94-90. Jewel Lloyd had her streak of 20-point games snapped at 5. The Storm 5-0 this season when Jewel Lloyd scores 20-plus, 0-2. When she does not. After that visit to the Sparks, the Storm back home as part of this home-heavy early schedule to host Atlanta on Sunday and Chicago next Tuesday, looking to continue this strong start. Moving on to UW Sports. As we mentioned at the top, UW Softball, after reaching the Women's College World Series Championship Series against Florida State, lost 1-0 in a Game 1 pitcher's duel as Gabby Plain was slightly outdueled by Megan King from the Seminoles, and then Game 2, a very different style game. The Huskies get 3 runs in the top of the first as Florida State's defense kind of collapsed, and everything's looking good then. But Taryn Alvello, getting the start in Game 2, could not maintain the lead, gave up 5 runs in the first 2 innings. A number of home runs by Florida State, which scored the most runs the Huskies have given up all season. Just the second time all year they had given up more than 5, and as many runs in the Game 2 8-3 loss as the Huskies had given up in their previous 9 NCAA tournament games combined.
It was rough.
It was tough to see the Huskies go down in fashion like this because it was so different from what we've seen from them all season long.
Well, I mean, first in Game 1 of the series, because I thought that I would be coming on here angry about that, and especially some of the coaching decisions that happened in Game 1.
You said that you needed to find out who UW's manager was, and then you were going to be upset about her. It's Heather Tarr, by the way. Heather Tarr.
But after that Game 2 loss, it was just like, Florida State is so good at hitting.
Who are they the sixth seed?
They're the really good hitter.
Jessie Warren.
Because she had a ball where... I think this was in the first game where it was way outside and she hit it off the wall.
It was like, a waste pitch. I mean, I don't think you can cork your bat when you have metal bats, but it seemed like their bats were corked. Like, yeah. What the heck?
She's good. And especially you look at the UW bats and you're like, there's just no offense here.
Yes, which was an issue throughout the Women's College World Series, but they were able to play all these pitchers' duels throughout. Like, Game 1 was what I expected from this series. And in Game 2, the floodgates opened, and UW was not prepared to play that style of game.
But just the decision, there's so much bunting that happens.
Yeah, but when you play a 1-0 game, it makes sense to bunt.
It doesn't make sense to bunt when there's one out and a runner on second, to bunt the runner to third and have 2 outs. That does not make sense in any situation. That is a bad decision, as we know from almost all things related to sports.
When did they do that?
That was in game one.
Which inning?
Like the sixth inning. I think they were the game might have been tied or they were down 1-0. And that happened. And it was just a terrible decision, right? The thing that we know from sports and the thing that I feel like we've learned the most in, say, 5 to 10 years is that taking as many cracks at something as possible is the best way to get the odds on your side in sports. And what they are doing in this situation is they are giving up one of those chances.
Look, I haven't seen any studies on it, but you can't apply baseball research to softball because they're totally different run in offensive environment.
It's not even necessarily baseball research, though. It's just watching the sport and having common sense and know that, okay, so you have a runner on second. You have two cracks at getting a hit and probably scoring that runner. And what you're doing is you're giving away one of those chances.
I mean, I don't know about that particular decision or what was going on there.
It was a bad... There's constant and rampant bunting happening. Again, it happens in college baseball also. Watching college baseball, just like, stop bunting! Stop bunting!
I mean, there it makes less sense because the metal bats are more problematic in baseball because they don't throw like really hard underhand from like 35 feet away. I don't know what the actual mound distance is, but it feels like it's like 20 feet away. Yeah, softball's hard. That's why I don't know how Florida State was able to hit like so many home runs. All of these home runs. They had more home runs in that game than UW had in the entire NCAA tournament, I'm pretty sure.
It was frustrating to watch, just some of that decision-making and not maximizing outs in the same way.
I think it was tough to see the UW defense not play well in game two of this series. I mean, that had been good, so good for
everything fell apart in game two.
But yeah. You also saw Florida State have a lot of success stealing bases on UW's freshman catcher.
Left-handed catcher, it's kind of weird.
Yeah.
I'm like, if they steal third, how is she going to, with a right-hand hitter, how are you going to make that throw?
Yeah, I mean, they faced at least one other team with a left-hand catcher in the WCWS, so it's not as uncommon in softball as it is in baseball. So, I mean, the disappointing thing about this is, you know, I think the Huskies have a chance to be very good next year, but they lose 5 starters on the offense, including their entire outfield. Julia DuPont, their leading home run hitter in left field, Kelly Burdick in center field, Tristan Melhart with her terrific catches in right field, then also Taylor Van Zee, their best hitter for average, and first baseman Kirsten Thomas. The good news is they bring back, of course, their entire pitching staff with Elvello and Gabby Plain, who was such a stud as a freshman, and then probably will get back junior catcher Morgan Flores, who missed the entire season due to an undisclosed injury, forcing the freshman Emma Helm into the lineup at catcher, where, you know, she did well, all things considered, but kind of finally caught up to the Huskies in this championship series. So going to need to find a lot of offense and didn't have enough of it ultimately in the Women's College World Series as it was.
But we can expect them to be very good next year.
Yeah, I mean, the pitching is going to be great. That's going to be a huge strength for the Huskies.
What about UW baseball?
UW baseball, as we talked about briefly in our Women's College World Series preview, went 3-0 to win the Conway Regional, beating UConn twice and host Coastal Carolina to reach the Super Regionals for the first time.
Yes!
In program history.
Really, a toast to UW baseball. We have none of us have any beer left. By the way, this beer's all right. I don't know.
Yeah, it wasn't quite as good as I expected. Now face Cal State Fullerton, which upset Stanford on the road in their Super Regional. Stanford, this was a huge upset. Stanford came in ranked number 2 by the consensus of baseball statistical rankings that I found on MasseyRankings.com. Mm-hmm. Fullerton was...
I consult that often.
44th.
Wow.
The Huskies are 45th coming into last weekend. Coastal Carolina was 12th and UConn 34th. So, I mean, Huskies going on the road here, which is a disadvantage, but this is an easier opponent, at least before you accounted for their upsetting Stanford, than the ones they beat last weekend.
So what is the series like with Cal State Fullerton?
It's a best of 3 now this weekend. So those will be played Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Game 1 is Friday at 11 a.m., Game 2 Saturday at 3:30 p.m., and then Game 3 will be Sunday at 6 p.m. if necessary.
And then the winner advances on to?
The College World Series.
Which has how many teams? 16?
Eight
teams.
Yeah, there's currently 16 teams. You go down from 64 to 16. 16 for the Super Regionals and 16 to 8. Yeah.
Interesting. Were any Huskies drafted? Are you aware of that?
I did not see that any of them got drafted.
I feel like now that I'm familiar with Husky baseball players, but you see Joe Wainhouse and he sure looks like a professional baseball player.
I mean, okay.
I don't know what year the players are though.
Wait, Graffinino could be selected?
Oh, look at that. AJ Graffinino.
He's a junior. I didn't realize that. AJ Graffinino was selected in the 8th round by the Atlanta Braves, who of course once had his father.
They had to draft him.
A 10th round pick of the Braves in 1990. And then Willie McIver was drafted in the 9th round as a catcher by the Colorado Rockies.
Willie McIver is a catcher? Because I thought Nick Cale was their catcher.
He's played mostly...
These are the things that I know about Husky baseball.
He's played mostly at third base, but according to the press release, Colorado is listing him as a catcher. That's okay. Where they intend for him to play if he drafts. Also, then a Husky signee, one of their incoming freshmen, Jason Schrader, picked in the 2nd round by the Astros.
2nd round?
Yeah.
So he's not coming to...
We'll see.
Still, pretty good for UW baseball.
The final round of the draft was today. Do not have an update yet on...
Are you able to see what year Joe Wainhouse is?
I'm sure I can figure that out. I mean, so much of it is whether you're eligible to be drafted among college baseball players, because that doesn't happen until typically after your junior year. Joe Wainhouse is a senior, so...
Maybe
he was drafted today. Let me keep doing research to see whether that happened. This is not something I was prepared for.
This is also not somebody anybody cares about.
For all of you Husky baseball fans out there. Let's see. Another UW signee, David Rhodes, drafted by the Mariners in the 40th round. Levi Jordan, drafted by the Cubs in the 29th round. UW signee, Alex Guerrero, drafted in the 18th round. Joe Demers, drafted in the 11th round.
Man, losing a lot of talent here.
And that appears to be it.
Okay.
So there you go.
Well...
Any other thoughts on UW baseball now that you've watched that one game?
I've watched two games now.
Oh, two games. Okay. Oh, that's right. You attended one game.
I'm a Husky baseball super fan. I'm 11 a.m. on Friday. I'm going to be tuning in.
Okay. On the men's basketball front, they got a commitment on Wednesday from 2019 wing Raekwon Battle from Marysville, a 6'5" shooting guard who plays for Marysville Pilchuck in Seattle Rotary, AAU. He is known as a top outside shooter and has already talked about getting to work recruiting other players to join him as part of the 2019
from
class.
From Marysville Pilchuck?
No, I think probably more the players he plays with and against at the AAU level.
I also came up with a nickname for him.
What's that?
The Chef.
It is not spelled like Raekwon the Chef.
Oh, it's not?
It's spelled Raekwon.
Ah, okay.
Kind of like Daquan Cook, the longtime NBA guard. And I think that's pretty much it. I don't know if you have anything else to add this week. Look forward to watching the Huskies in that Super Regional. And now that we're a baseball school officially, we didn't circle back to, we mentioned this on the preview pod on Monday. Congrats to UW Rowing for winning the national championship of sorts in rowing.
Of sorts. Huge congrats. National championship of sorts.
Well, they don't call it the national championship the same way. It doesn't work the same because I don't think it's, I'm not sure if it's even an NCAA sport officially.
Congrats on winning the national championship or whatever. I think that's what the 1960 UW national championship is.
It is, of course, the James Tin Eich Trophy as the overall points winner at the Intercollegiate Rowing Association. Alas, they lost the big individual prize, the Varsity 8 Grand Final, to Yale. But still, the Huskies finishing with 211 points, total points, having won the 2nd and 3rd Varsity 8 Grand Finals to win the Tin Eich Trophy for the 15th time in school history.
Nice. Well, congrats of sorts.
On that note.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks.